Today on Against the Grain, are we facing a new Cold War with Russia? Does that country represent a serious threat to the United States? I'm Sasha Lilly. Tony Wood joins me to separate myths from facts about Russia's domestic and foreign policy. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Following the disintegration of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, Russia became an ally of the United States. Boris Yeltsin, with the help of advisors like Jeffrey Sachs from the U.S., set Russia on a rapid path to capitalism. But now, under the leadership of Vladimir Putin, Russia and the United States face off. And Western commentators tell us it's because Putin represents a return to the authoritarian Soviet past. Tony Wood contends, however, in his book Russia Without Putin, that Putin doesn't represent a break from the Yeltsin years, but instead a variant of the system that was put in place at that time. Tony, before we can talk about Russian society beyond Putin, the question needs to be raised, why does the media take Putin as a stand-in for all of Russia?
There are different components to this. I think one of them is just a general trend in media coverage of politics that applies not just to Russia, but to the rest of the world too. You know, that these sort of, it's partly a kind of phenomenon of celebrity culture in some ways, but also the kind of focus on individual figures as standing in for wider ideological trends or developments. And so you see this personalization of politics that's been happening really for a long time now. But it's certainly true in the UK that everything around Brexit and all of the larger issues that that involves get framed in terms of what effect it's having on Theresa May's political fortunes, you see. And also, you know, in France, everything is now revolving around Emmanuel Macron. Turkey, everything is filtered through the lens of Erdogan. So to some extent, this angle on Russia, the focus on Putin to the detriment of the rest of Russia is not particular to Russia in that regard. But on the other hand, I do think there's an additional component to this in the case of Russia that makes it somewhat more extreme in its effects, which is that there is a real dearth of knowledge of Russia in the West. I think that's become more accentuated since the end of the Cold War with the decline in, you know, university funding for research, among many other things like that. If people want to see something of Russia beyond Putin, they don't have that many, the general audience at least doesn't have that many places they can go for that information. So I think I think the problem I try and point to in the book is that this tendency is very self-confirming, you know, that if all news stories about Russia have to in some sense be pinned to Putin, then every successive news story also has to be pinned to Putin in some way. And so it has this sort of narrowing effect on our perspective that makes it increasingly difficult to talk about anything else.
How does that focus on Putin, the man, by the Western media, by Western critics, contrast or not to how he's seen in Russia itself? Is he seen as this figure who in many ways has become a stand-in for the rest of society?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot in common as well in Russian media coverage and perceptions of him, too. And that's partly where a lot of the Western correspondents, at least, they had their own ideas reinforced, right? That this is a depiction of the current ruling system in Russia. This is how it likes to depict itself, partly because, you know, Putin has his own interests in magnifying his personal role and making himself the indispensable figure in this system. That's really how you survive. At the top of that system is making yourself indispensable and making it unthinkable for you to be replaced. So I have a quote in the book from one of the presidential staff advisors in 2014 saying, "No Russia, no Putin." Like, but you could draw this direct equation between just the life of the man and the existence of the entire country. Now, and this is a totally preposterous idea, obviously, logically, but what it really means is that this system sees itself as totally, its destiny is totally interwoven with this one man. And what I argue in the book is that this is a self-serving description that we shouldn't accept at face value, that it's analytically accurate.
We are told, and it's kind of a piece with the focus on Putin himself, that Putin is part of a continuum that dates back to the Soviet Union of a larger-than-life figure ruling through authoritarian rule. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, I think this is certainly something you see. I mean, more or less every book on Russia these days has to begin with some kind of potted biography of Putin, and a great deal of emphasis is placed on his childhood during the Soviet Union, his growing up in the kind of Brezhnev era, watching these kind of TV series glorifying the KGB, and then his service within the KGB, especially his time in East Germany. But not clear what he did, probably spying on dissidents or, you know, some kind of low-level espionage work. And so this is where people get this idea that he is a kind of direct throwback to the Soviet era. But actually, I read his political career somewhat differently. And I think I'm not totally alone in this, and I think all of the evidence I've got for this is in all these other biographies of Putin is right there. I think it's just a question of emphasis that I think that the most distinctive things about him as a politician and as a leader are not the product of that Soviet period and that Soviet background, but actually they're the product of his emergence in the 1990s. And I see him very much as a product of that period. And the way you see this, most clearly is in his role in the 1990s as deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. He was deputy to the elected mayor, Anatoly Sobchak. And as deputy mayor, he was in charge of St. Petersburg's contacts, its business dealings with foreign companies. So this was at a moment, you know, 1992, when the Russian economy is beginning to open up and be redistributed into private hands. And there are a lot of very lucrative contracts. And Putin at that point was in a very, very key position for the city government. And this is, you know, Russia's second city by population. So he's sitting on a kind of a pile of resources, if you like. And what he learned in his time as deputy mayor, which I think was from 1992 to 96, he was just very much located at that intersection of government, business, and I think in all likelihood organized crime. And he understood, he learned very much how those three things work together, who you had to be loyal to, how to navigate the complexities of that that combination of factors. And I think that's the thing that really accounts to him as a politician, not growing up in the Soviet Union in the, you know, 60s, 70s, or, you know, whenever it was that people think was most decisive. I think it's really the 90s that are formative for him.
Well, take us back to that time, to 1991, the disintegration of the Soviet Union. What happened in the years that followed, which you are arguing are so important for us in thinking about why Russia is as it is today?
I think, you know, this is a very large and complex subject, but I think what I try and do in the book is focus on, I would say, two major rapid transformations, if you like, that happen. One is in the realm of politics, where you have, over the course of 91 to 93, the emergence of a very presidentially dominated political system. For the first couple of years, there are tensions between the elected parliament and the elected president, Boris Yeltsin. And in 1993, you know, there is a standoff between the two, and eventually Yeltsin sends in tanks and literally bombs the parliament in submission, and shortly thereafter writes a new constitution, which is approved in a somewhat suspicious referendum in December 1993. And that constitution gives the president of Russia really far more power than most presidents have in Western Europe or in the U.S. He has very, very broad executive authority, and very importantly, legislature. The legislature is under the presidential control, if you like. He can dismiss the government when he feels like. He invites people to form governments more or less at will. So it's a hyper-presidential system that emerges by 1993. Now, I borrow a term from a Russian political scientist called Dmitry Fuhrman. He calls the system that it developed in the early 1990s imitation democracy. And what he means by that is it's, you know, formally speaking, democratic. They have to have elections every few years and to legitimate the government of the day. But it's a system in which the opposition cannot be allowed to come to power, right? So you have this spectacle of elections every few years, but the same regime has to stay in place. And so that, to me, is the founding contradiction of the Russian system that came after 1991, is that it has to be democratic, but it's committed to a project of capitalist transformation that means you cannot allow the people to actually have their say, because they would reject that agenda, as was proven during the 1990s in various elections. When the Russians had the chance, they voted against that economic program. It takes me on to the second transformation that happens. That's the political system. You get this formally democratic but actually non-democratic, very presidential political system set in place. And at the same time, what happens after 1991 is a very rapid transformation of the economy, and in particular, a very rapid and chaotic upward distribution of income and property. So you have a state socialist planned economy that's in crisis, and pieces of it are appropriated by various businessmen, private actors, former managers. It's a very chaotic, turbulent time in which property rights are not clear. But certainly what happens is very, very quickly you get a new layer of wealthy property owners emerge in Russia, and they're going to be the makings of a new economic elite. So you have a very quick process of elite formation, and at the same time, most of the population is doing much, much worse. Mass unemployment, mass hunger, a lot of excess death from, you know, much worse health indicators. Male life expectancy drops by 5 years in the first half of the 1990s. So basically you have this very quick creation of inequalities, especially economic inequalities, but inequalities of all kinds develop very rapidly under this formally democratic but non-democratic political system.
And what role did the United States play in that process in the 1990s? We think of Russia, the U.S., as having a great deal of distance from Russia today, but what role did it take in the 90s?
Well, the U.S. was certainly involved both at the governmental level, and also I think it's very important to stress at the non-governmental level in terms of individual actors from think tanks and from U.S. academia. I mean, there was a stream of people traveling to Russia to advise the Russian government on what to do, on how to reform their economy, how to conduct privatization. I mean, this is documented fact that the people who actually drafted some of the key laws in Russia in the early 1990s were not Russians. They were American advisors working for President Yeltsin. They sat there and wrote the laws of this country on who should own what. And I think that's something many people in the U.S. don't really know, but it's certainly something people in Russia know. And I think that's one of the things which I'm sure we'll come on to later about the divergence of the kind of animosity that's developed between these two countries over the last, you know, 10 years or however far back you want to trace it. I think that basically the Russians remember the 1990s very differently from how the U.S. sees it. And one of these factors is the key role played by Americans, not just the State Department and diplomats in supporting the Yeltsin government, but also academics, experts, think tank people sent in and really helping push through this transformation of the Soviet economy, which benefited a handful of people, but was actually quite a bad development for most people.
Tony Wood is my guest. We're talking about his book, Russia Without Putin: Money, Power, and the Myths of a New Cold War. That's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So to what degree is there a break with Putin following the Yeltsin years, and to what degree do we see continuity? You're arguing for the latter. Western critics frequently argue that the transition to capitalism started in the 1990s, went kind of terribly wrong, and what we've ended up with Putin, and that Putin really represents something very different. You know, often the term mafia state is used. Now, Putin did, in fact, make some economic changes that restored state control in some sectors. How do you see, particularly just focusing on the level of the state, the differences and similarities between the period of the Yeltsin era and Putin?
Yeah, this is a very kind of common depiction of Russia, that there is this sort of watershed of 1999-2000, and that, you know, there is this chaotic but nonetheless democratic and economically liberal pro-market phase in the 1990s, and then comes Putin, who is much more statist, much more authoritarian, and a different kind of figure from Yeltsin, much less willing to tolerate diverse media and so on. But what I try and do in the book is really underscore continuity between the two, not to say that they're the same, but to try and see them as phases in the development of a single system, right? So it's not really a rupture. It's more an evolution of the same system. And so I see Yeltsin as the kind of turbulent phase of creation of that system, and Putin as the phase of consolidation. And the role of the state that you've highlighted really is an important one to single out there. But in a sense, the Yeltsin years are the phase when the state is being reshaped. And it's not clear what authority it's going to have over the territory, over the economy. There's a lot still being hashed out, and often in a literal fights, erupting over property in the 1990s. By the time you get to Putin, the economy has somewhat recovered. Very importantly, oil prices have recovered. And so by 1999, 2000, the Russian state is a much more capable entity. It's able to pay pensions. It's able to pay its own employees' wages on time. It's just a much more effective set of structure than it was in the 1990s. So Putin inherits a state with much greater capacity than Yeltsin had. In terms of the state's role in the economy, it's certainly true that the state under Putin expanded its grip on key sectors such as natural resources, oil, gas, that kind of thing. But I think there are two things that's important to bear in mind here. One is that state control or even ownership of natural resources is totally compatible with capitalism, right? State ownership of oil companies is actually the norm, globally speaking. It's only the U.S. that has private oil companies be just the norm in the industry. If you look at countries like Saudi Arabia, Norway, any of the other major oil producers, the norm is to have a state-owned oil company because that is a key source of revenue for those states. And without it, you can't run a capitalist economy in the rest of the economy, right? So Russia was actually, in some ways, reverting to something more like the norm where you have majority state-owned companies in control of strategic sectors that guarantee the state's finances. But the rest of the economy, in terms of what it does, in terms of providing all kinds of goods to the population at large, all kinds of export goods, all of that is done on a market basis entirely and largely privately owned. So you could imagine the Russian economy as being split into two very unequal portions. One is a state-owned portion in charge of natural resources, and all of the rest of it is a privately owned market, privately owned entities run on market principles. I guess the other important thing to bear in mind is that often Russian companies, even if they're state-owned, they don't behave like state-owned companies, and they don't act necessarily in the interests of the state, right? They will often do things that are not at all strategic from the point of view of the state. One key example of this is in 2008, the run-up to the global financial crisis. State-owned or majority state-owned companies such as Gazprom, Rosneft in the oil sector, they had loaded up on debt in Europe. Now, from the point of view of a nationally oriented state-owned economy, that would not be a smart thing to do because it would expose you to all kinds of market fluctuations in the West. But all of these companies did that because it enabled them to hike up their share prices and pay bigger dividends. Now, that's the behavior of a capitalist company in the West, and that would be entirely rational, and that's how we got the crash that we did. So it just shows to me that, in a way, whether or not something is state-owned in Russia is sometimes not the key factor. The key factor is really how this company behaves, whether it's state-owned or private.
What about the argument that capitalism in Russia has not been of a healthy variety because of the distortions of the Soviet past? Clearly, we know that history does shape the present in various ways. Is the Soviet past a hindrance on capitalism today, whether or not there's direct continuities between Putin and the state, and you're arguing that there isn't, but are there other ways that the emergence of capitalism in Russia was changed fundamentally because of the transition from the Soviet system?
I mean, this is in some ways the area where my book breaks most with the conventional wisdom, I think. It is very widespread to feel that the weight of the Soviet past does account for a lot of Russia's contemporary problems. And the corollary to that, logically, is that the sooner the Soviet legacy disappears, the more Russia will approximate a normal, in quote marks, functioning market economy. Now, I happen to think that the reverse is true, that actually the legacies of the Soviet past were what enabled the capitalist system to be consolidated, and that without those legacies, the 1990s would have been much more unstable, much more turbulent and chaotic, and the current system you see under Putin would not have had a chance to consolidate itself. The example I would give of this is that during the 1990s, people would often continue to show up to jobs in factories, right? These Soviet-era factories still turning out goods that couldn't be sold. People would turn up to work, and they would not be able to make anything because there were no inputs in industry. They would continue to show up, however, and they would often not be paid. They would continue to show up because the job in the factory is what enabled them to get access to housing or enabled them to get access to childcare or their residency to send their child to school. So there's a way in which the persistence of that Soviet-era social infrastructure, those jobs, provided a kind of, I call it a subsidy to the capitalist system that was then being developed. If you'd had to suddenly start from scratch and build a brand new capitalist system without any of that overhang of Soviet era social infrastructure, it would have been impossible, or it would have, erupted in civil war or something much worse very, very early on. It would have been a real disaster.
Well, let me ask you more about that. If that subsidy, in effect, didn't exist during those times, we know that the transition to capitalism was really catastrophic in human terms. You mentioned that male life expectancy fell by 5 years in the 1990s, which I think is pretty unprecedented outside of times of war. So had these subsidies not existed, how do you think it would have played out politically, and how did it play out politically at the time? Obviously, the 90s are different than the 2000s, but in terms of popular opposition to what was happening, given how rapidly life changed, often for the worse?
I think one of the ways in which it played out was that a lot of the discontent was somehow muted, I think, because people still continued to show up for these jobs, for example, but often they wouldn't get paid. Or they would get paid, 6 months later, or they would get paid in goods rather than in cash. If you'd had to start from scratch, there literally would have been nowhere for those people to go from one day to the next. There would have actually been a large pool of people available for some kind of alternative political project or some kind of uprising or whatever you want to call it. When you throw that quantity of people out of employment, you have a large pool of surplus people with nothing better to do than challenge the existing system. One of the very striking things about the 1990s in Russia is that even though unemployment was high relative to what it had been before, right, they were close to zero unemployment, and then they suddenly had something like 7 or 8% unemployment. But the key thing that doesn't really get factored into that is the phenomenon of underemployment, where people do show up for work, but they're not doing anything, and they're not getting any pay. They're not getting paid. So that is not reflected in unemployment figures. They don't count as unemployed. And I think also it's important to register that politically, they don't think of themselves as unemployed, right? They still have a stake in the survival of the remnants of the old system, and they're making do as best they can until something else comes along. And that's essentially that what happened in the 1990s was that transition from old to new, where people were less willing to challenge the new system because they still had some tiny fraction of something that they needed to hold on to and that they didn't want to lose.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with the author of Russia Without Putin, Money, Power, and the Myths of the New Cold War. That's published by Verso Books. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org, and its author is Tony Wood. He's on the editorial board of New Left Review, and his other books include Chechnya, The Case for Independence. So you've been talking about how Russia has changed since the 1990s, the traumatic, very compressed transition to capitalism that happened in the 1990s, and whether Russia today owes its turmoil to the Soviet past or to that history. I wonder if you could trace for us the evolution, bearing in mind those changes, the changes that have happened since the 1990s within Russian society. If you could trace for us the evolution of Russia's foreign policy since the restoration of capitalism, since we're told that Russia and Putin in particular are hell-bent on conflict with the West, how would you trace Russia's foreign policy from the 1990s to the present?
I think in some ways the 1990s are the obvious starting point, but actually I think one has to go slightly further back to understand it fully, because it's really under Gorbachev that you have a reorientation of Soviet foreign policy, and obviously Russia as the largest state within the USSR was the main main component of that and shaped Soviet foreign policy itself. In the mid-1980s, you have what they called the new thinking take root in the USSR, and this was really a sharp reorientation of Soviet foreign policy away from confrontation with the West, and away from this idea of a systemic contrast between the Soviet system and Western Europe in particular. Certainly Gorbachev's idea was that the Soviet Union could reform itself into a kind of semi-marketized socialist system, and it would join in with Europe in some larger community of states. He called it our common European home, right? That was the vision that Gorbachev had. Now, in 1991, obviously, the USSR disintegrates. Russia is one of 15 states that emerged from that process. And at that point, the idea of a kind of integration with the West as a set of socially democratic social democratically oriented states, the idea that Russia would be integrating with peers on that basis just vanished, right? That this is a state that's its economy is collapsing, it's in crisis, and Russia was really rapidly trying to redefine its interests. And under Yeltsin, what effectively took place was a kind of realignment of Russian foreign policy in favor of the West. It was a very pro-Western government in the first half of the 1990s. And at that point, the vision in Russia is we have abandoned the Soviet past. We are leaving behind all of those commitments, those alliances with Arab client states, for example. We're going to abandon those, and we're going to seek closer cooperation with the West, alliance with the West, if possible, integration into its security architecture and into other institutional structures that are around. And so this, again, may strike many listeners as, you know, delusional, but at the time there was a lot of Russian thinking about would they be able to join the EU, would they eventually join NATO. Those were not crazy thoughts to be having in the first half of the 1990s or even into the late 1990s. And it's certainly, you know, again, worth recalling that when Vladimir Putin met Bill Clinton in late 2000, he asked Clinton, how would you feel about Russia joining NATO? And this was something that Clinton, you know, he was on his way out. He said he would personally be in favor of it, right? So there is a moment, most of the 1990s and into the 2000s, where the idea of Russia aligning itself with the West is the predominant view in Russia, that is the goal of Russian foreign policy. That's the dominant school of thought, I guess I should say, because there is also this other strand of Russian foreign policy thinking that's much more statist and much more based on the idea that Russia has interests that are separate from those of the West, distinct from those of the West, and that those interests will sometimes need to be insisted upon and defended. And that school of thought starts to gain some influence in the late 1990s, especially after the ruble crisis of 1998. And so by the time Putin comes to power, the predominant orientation is still that of forging some kind of alliance with the West. But there is increasingly this other current that thinks Russia has interests that are not identifiable with those of the West. And so there is a kind of clash between these two worldviews happening. And it's become common again to think that Putin from the beginning was set on confrontation with the West, that he's hostile to Western democratic values. And I just think this isn't true. This is not borne out by the historical record. I think we have to think of Putin in his first two presidential terms, at least, as incarnating some kind of synthesis of the pro-Western view of the Yeltsin era in the 1990s and this more statist line that was coming forth in the late 1990s as a sort of minor current in Russian thinking. Up until the mid-2000s, he's able to balance those two things, right? Often he'll go to an international summit and do a list of grievances Russia has against the West, right? And these are often quite spiky public appearances. Western diplomats don't really like to be told these things. But on the other hand, he's not made any directly hostile moves, and he's still insisting on Russia as a European country. He wants closer integration with the EU. He wants visa-free travel, all of these things. It's a very westward-oriented policy, but it has a list of complaints attached to that. So those contradictions are there until, I would say, the late 2000s, up until 2010. Well, up until 2008, more or less, I would say. But you have to look back through that trajectory to see that Russia is sort of, there are different ideas in circulation there, and it's only much more recently that the idea of confrontation has come to the fore.
Tell us about the 2014 crisis in the Ukraine. In fact, remind us about it and how that shaped Russian foreign policy since then.
Yeah, I think the Ukraine crisis is certainly a major watershed. I think probably, you know, in the future, people are going to see this as the real turning point in Russia's relations with the West, because I actually think that the idea of alliance with or integration or cooperation with the West, that persists in Russian policy up until the Ukraine crisis. Dmitry Medvedev, who was president from 2008 to 2012, and then Putin returns in 2012, but he was very keen on this idea of integration with the West, and that persisted as a motif throughout his presidency. It's really the Ukraine crisis that drives home the idea that Russia and the West have fundamentally distinct and opposed interests. Up until that point, you could argue it back and forth, or you might have some more optimistic idea.
And can you remind people what happened in the Ukraine?
Sure. Then? I mean, Ukraine is really the meeting point of, I guess, the expansion of NATO and the expansion of the EU and the ambitions of Western Europe to influence the shape of the states around it, right? The leading role initially in Ukraine was played by the EU. And the idea was that the EU had this sort of greater neighborhood, and it would expand, if not membership, then certainly closer economic integration and cooperation to the states around it in exchange for those countries aligning themselves with Western Europe and opening up their economies to European goods. And Ukraine was certainly part of that design. And the problem really from the Ukrainian point of view is that this meant Ukraine was faced with a choice. Either it could turn to the West and integrate more closely with the EU, or it could turn to the East and maintain its existing strong connections with Russia. A lot of Eastern Ukraine is actually economically very closely integrated with Russia, as well as demographically. A lot of the populations there had links back and forth across the border. And so Ukraine is this place where you get a zero-sum game being played out between the EU, and on the one hand, and NATO with it, and on the other hand, Russia's desire in maintaining its own sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. Now, this, you know, over the course of the 2000s, you had different leaders get elected in Ukraine, and you had a contested election in 2004, which was rigged in favor of a pro-Russian candidate, and then there were street protests, and then eventually the pro-Western candidate won the new elections that were held. That was called the Orange Revolution, which I think a lot of your listeners might remember. But the thing to bear in mind is that after 2005, when the Orange Revolution succeeded, there was still a back and forth in Ukraine between leaders who favored integration with the West and leaders who favored maintaining links with Russia. And Ukraine has been essentially, you know, divided between those two larger policy options throughout the last sort of 15 years or so. That's really the dilemma facing Ukraine. What happened in 2013-14 is that you had a government in power. Viktor Yanukovych was the president at that time, who was a pro-Moscow president. And he was offered an association deal with the EU, which involved essentially making that strategic choice in favor of Europe. And at a certain point, he, having agreed to the deal, he did a U-turn and said he wasn't going to sign the deal. And this brought forth a lot of street protests. A lot of the pro-European sentiment in Ukraine turned against this president, who was seen as being too much pro-Russia. And that's really where you get the Maidan movement of late 2013, early 2014 develop, and it ends with Yanukovych being removed from power in February 2014. Now, that whole series of events is seen very differently in the West and in Russia, in the Russian government circles, I should say, because of the preceding 10 years of battling between different factions in Ukraine who favored integration with the West and those who favored Russia. It's seen as this is the point where the zero-sum contest reached its outcome and it swung into favor of the West. And the Russians were very unhappy with this, and Putin saw this as an attempt by the West to seize control of Ukraine. Now, that obviously, there are many things wrong with that picture. That leaves out of the account whatever the Ukrainians themselves wanted, so I'm not endorsing that depiction. But this is just to explain why Russia then moved so aggressively in Ukraine to try and claw back the influence it had had and to try and push back against the EU and US increase in influence in Ukraine after Yanukovych flees from power.
Tony Wood is my guest. We're discussing his book, Russia Without Putin, Money, Power, and the Myths of a New Cold War. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. As, in fact, the title of your book alludes to, we are told now that Russia, under Putin's helmsmanship, is in a new Cold War with the United States. Why do you think that term should be rejected? And is Russia, in fact, a threat to the United States?
Yeah, I think the two points you made there are actually connected in some ways. I mean, I think it's worth, everyone bearing in mind that the Cold War was a contest not only between two blocks of states, but between rival systems, rival ideological systems, but also rival socioeconomic systems. They were very, fundamentally different ways of organizing societies. And it was really a contest between those two outlooks. And it was fought globally, right? Every single part of the world, more or less, was involved in this struggle, either directly or by proxy. Now, the current conflict between the U.S. and Russia doesn't have anything like that global reach, and other states are not being dragged into this. This is not playing out in Central Africa or in Southeast Asia or in Latin America in any way. And it's also, there is no real ideological contrast between these states. These are not rival systems. These are different capitalist powers that happen to disagree with each other and happen to have interests that do not align. But basically, I think the term Cold War, to describe that contest, is very misleading. It gives it this idea of a larger, more meaningful ideological clash, and I just don't think we're operating on that kind of terrain. And in terms of whether Russia is a threat to the U.S., I mean, I think generally speaking, there is a tendency, certainly in U.S. policymaking circles, to exaggerate the threat posed by any given state to the U.S. I think this language of threat and security is much overused by the U.S. in order to justify massive military expenditure and to justify the maintenance of, whatever it is, 200 bases globally. I mean, this is really a global military power without peer, without even a remotely close peer on a global level. So the idea that anyone could actually pose a direct existential threat to the U.S., certainly a military threat to the U.S., is science fiction, as far as I'm concerned, in the present context. And I think you can measure this by looking at military expenditures of Russia and the U.S. I mean, in per capita terms, certainly U.S. military expenditure just dwarfs that of Russia. And in terms of the economic weight of these countries, Russia is many times less wealthy and powerful than the U.S. I mean, In per capita terms, U.S. GDP per capita is like something like 5.5, maybe even 6 times that of Russia at the moment. Right? These are not commensurable powers. And I believe the increase in U.S. military spending from 2017 to 18, that is just the increase, was more than the entire Russian military budget for last year. Right? So that just gives you an idea of, If we're looking at this as a direct contest, it's just such a mismatch that it's not possible to imagine that these countries pose any kind of, can be measured as equal players on any kind of battlefield. I think the real question one has to look at is to reframe this in other terms, that if you imagine that Russia is a large, certainly important country, a large regional player with a significant army and a significant stock of warheads and other military capacities. But nonetheless, if you measure it according to, if you measure it in comparison with other states that that are in a similar bracket, you would be looking at states like Brazil, like Turkey, then those countries are not often discussed as existential threats to the U.S., right? So the question is, why is Russia framed in those terms and those states are not? And obviously it's because its interests do not align. But I think these are very different facts, essentially. One is, does it have interests that are distinct from those of the U.S.? And the other question is, does it pose a direct threat? And I think one needs to separate those two things out because factually they're very distinct. And in terms of what policy decisions they lead to, they're very distinct.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of outrage and one might call it hysteria around the attempts by Russia, whether effective or not, to influence U.S. elections. Stepping back, as you have been doing, and looking at the relationship between Russia and the United States in a context that takes into account how the U.S. and the West also are relating to Russia, how do you understand those attempts to influence elections?
Yeah, I think there is a tendency to, well, I guess there's a tendency to conflate the Russian attempt to influence the election with Russian success in deciding the outcome of the election. And again, those are two very different things logically and empirically and in terms of what policy decisions they would lead to. I mean, I think there are a couple of things worth bearing in mind. One is that there's no way of knowing this, but I'm pretty convinced that the Russians did not expect Donald Trump to win the 2016 presidential election. I think they, like absolutely everyone else in the U.S. media commentary establishment and in the U.S. political establishment, I think they were convinced that Hillary Clinton would win. So I think really the function of the Russian meddling was to send Hillary Clinton a message that the Russians were not going to be happy about her election and that they were, you know, trying to just sort of troll her, essentially. That was the level at which it was operating. And then much to their surprise, Donald Trump was elected. Now, I don't think he has been, there has been any benefit for Russia in Donald Trump's election, partly because of this hysteria surrounding the idea of Russian meddling, and that has meant that U.S. policy towards Russia has actually been much more hawkish under Trump than under Obama. I mean, and this is one thing I would say to people who get very exercised about the idea that Putin is controlling Trump somehow, is that there is no real evidence that the Trump government has done anything to advance the interests of Russia. If anything, the reverse, right? Over the past, you know, 2.5 years, you've seen a series of developments that are very bad news as far as Russia is concerned, right? One is sanctions have been enshrined in U.S. law by Congress. Now, normally, again, they're often the prerogative of the presidency or they're done by executive order, but this is actually enshrined in law by Congress, and it's going to be very, very hard for any U.S. Congress to undo those. So sanctions on Russia as a permanent fixture of U.S. policy are there, and that is not something the Russians would have wanted. Lethal assistance to the Ukrainian military was something the Obama administration considered and then decided against for several years, and that's now something that, again, Congress has done under President Trump. And thirdly, pulling out of the nuclear deal was something the Trump administration has done. That's very bad news. That's a massive setback as far as the Russian foreign policy agenda in the Middle East is concerned. So you can see there's just a series of things where the actual outcome of the Trump presidency for Russia has been markedly negative. So I think they certainly didn't get what they bargained for because they were expecting Clinton. But I think if they thought Trump would be better for them than Clinton, they've also been mistaken. So the idea that Russia is somehow winning out of the Trump presidency and out of its meddling, I think, is actually mistaken.
How do you see the future of Russia, given all of these forces you've been talking about, and also given a reconfiguring world where the status of the United States has been shifting, certainly under Trump? There's the rise of China. What can we imagine in terms of looking to the future? I realize it entails a bit of crystal ball gazing, but what would you say the future has in store?
Yeah, I mean, I try and do a bit of this in the book's final chapter, exactly to precisely sort of think a bit about what what the possible options are for Russia, what constraints it faces, as well as opportunities. And I think really that, the fate of U.S. power in the world is the one that's going to decide really what role all states in the world can play, but Russia very much included. I think, you know, we're in a moment since the Cold War where the U.S. has been the single dominant power on the world stage. There's a lot of talk in different circles among analysts about eventually will we get to some multipolar system where there are a variety of balanced powers but no single one dominating, or will we have a China-dominated world order? And as far as I'm concerned, we're still a very long way for any of those scenarios. I think for the foreseeable future, the U.S. will continue to be the dominant power on the global stage, but with China increasingly weighty in economic terms. And so I think Russia is going to have to navigate between those two powers somehow. Is it going to have a closer economic and strategic relationship with China, particularly in the light of its increasingly tense relations with the U.S.? That would make a certain amount of strategic sense, certainly. So we may see some sort of tilting more towards China, both economically and politically in Russia. But on the other hand, I would say that, you know, you have to bear in mind that, that the whole pattern of Russian policy, the whole pattern of its economy, of its geography, is very much tilted towards the West. I mean, if you could imagine a map of Russia with a line down the middle where the Ural Mountains are, that's the sort of edge of European Russia, 75% of the population lives in 25% of the territory, right? So the bulk of the population, the bulk of the industry, the bulk of its economic activity is in that Western chunk of the country that is more closely connected to Western Europe than to Asia. And I think that pattern is going to take a very, very long time to shift eastward, to shift and connect it towards China. And so again, if there is going to be a very close relationship between Russia and China, I think that will take, you know, not just years, but possibly decades to emerge in its fullest form. So we may be looking at that by the end of the century, who knows. I think that there are some more immediate constraints operating on Russia that will shape where it goes in future. And one of those is its extreme dependence on exports of natural resources, especially oil and gas. These account for something like 70% to three-quarters of its export revenues at the moment, and that's a very, you know, high level. It makes it difficult for the Russian economy to diversify and to sort of create employment opportunities in other sectors. And that's actually, in the long run, a real problem for Russia because, I mean, one of the features of oil and gas, of course, is that it doesn't employ as many people as, say, manufacturing or, you know, other kinds of economic activity. So that's the real constraint that Russia has economically, is can it reduce its dependence on oil and gas and diversify into some other set of niches? And on the one hand, you know, it has a quite large, a well-educated population with a lot of technical skills. And so one could imagine a Russia that specialized in some other kind of high-value exports or tech or something like that. But the problem they have is that they have a somewhat dwindling and aging population as well, right? So a lot of developing countries have these, you know, growing populations that are getting increasingly educated and increasingly tech-savvy, and that's, you know, they're on an upward curve. Whereas demographically, Russia is in the opposite situation. It's more in the demographic situation of something like Western Europe or Japan, but without having reached those levels of wealth or economic diversification or anything like that. So I think Russia is stuck in this intermediate position, and it's going to have to make the best of its opportunities within a set of constraints that it's largely powerless to change on its own.
Let me end by asking you about the left in Russia. Is there a hope for a renewed left that isn't smothered by the weight of the Stalinist past?
Yeah, the fate of the left is obviously a question very close to my heart in Russia. I mean, I think on the one hand, you know, you do have a still sizable Communist Party in Russia that regularly gets something on the order of 20-25% of the vote. It used to be higher, but it's somewhat dwindling. It's not clear to me politically what that represents, right? They've sort of adopted a kind of broadly social democratic rhetoric with some somewhat ugly nationalist overtones at times. So it's a very curious party ideologically. And I think it's somewhat its prestige is somewhat diminished by having been kind of what they call in Russia the systemic opposition, i.e. it's an opposition party that operates within the Putin system and hasn't really represented a significant challenge to the ruling order for the last 30 years, right? So that's, but on the other hand, it's not going anywhere anytime soon. So that's a large voting bloc that in theory represents some version of left ideas. But the problem with that is that obviously it's also tainted in the minds of a large block of the population by association with the old communist order and by its unapologetic embrace of Stalinism and all of these old legacies of the sort of the dead weight, ideologically speaking, of the Soviet past. But I would say there are possibilities for the left in Russia, but they come out of a slightly more diverse, sort of heterogeneous set of social movements and left parties and trade unions, right? There are collections of very small movements that have emerged over the past 10, 15 years. There are quite militant new trade unions that have emerged, often in Western-owned factories in Russia, for example, car plants. There are also a lot of civic associations and NGOs, but also social movements. It's a wide range of groups active in Russia and concerned with different kinds of issues, sort of housing, healthcare, education, ecological movements. And again, these are very small and dispersed, but they have the makings of a social agenda that would be compatible with left ideas. And then lastly, there are several very small left parties, non-communist, and I guess you could also include anarchist parties in that as well. These are very, very small groups of people, but nonetheless ideologically and politically very creative. And I do still hold out some kind of hope that some kind of coalition could be knitted together out of that that collection of movements of diverse kinds. It would be a kind of necessarily somewhat shapeless coalition politics for a time, but some kind of common social agenda could come out of that. And I wouldn't exclude that being being partly attached to the Communist Party or some other systemic party in the long run, right? But I think that what gives me some kind of cause for optimism is the fact that I think the population's political center of gravity in Russia is somewhat to the left, certainly of the U.S., but I think also of Europe, that there is still a basic idea that things like free education and free healthcare are fundamental rights that all the population should have. Like, that's just an accepted view in Russia. And so if you had a collection of social movements that were willing to not only defend those basic principles, but expand them, enrich them, and give them a new kind of democratic civic content, I think there would be possibilities for that in future, I think.
Unfortunately, we're completely out of time. Tony Wood, thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on.
Tony Wood is the author of Russia Without Putin, Money, Power, and the Myths of a New Cold War. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.